Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
As we speak, the question of evolution is being debated in Congress and in classrooms across America. But while the debate continues, the world is beginning a process of devolution as higher and higher forms of life disappear from the land, the sea, and the air, the vacuum being replaced by ever more primitive forms of life. Nowhere is the change more evident than in the oceans. You're about to enter the slimy world of oceanic devolution. Don't go away. The Los Angeles Times this week has featured a five-part series on the oceans. Years of research have led to the series, written by Robert Weiss. I nominate it for a Pulitzer right now. The picture is at best grim. The series uncovers some very painful and disturbing truths about where the oceans are headed. I encourage all of you to track the links which I've posted on today's show page and read the full series. One of the researchers featured in the series is about to tell you about this devolution taking place in the oceans. Let's listen in now. This week in the LA Times has been a front page feature running 5 days featuring the plight of the oceans, and it's one of the more incredibly effective in-depth discussions of this topic, particularly in such a mainstream media and on the front page. It's exciting to see, although it is very, in many respects, depressing. One of the players who has participated in this particular story and is featured, as a matter of fact, is a scientist, researcher, educator, Dr. Jeremy Jackson, who is a professor of oceanography at the legendary Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Dr. Jackson, welcome to the Wildside News. First of all, give us a little background in the focus of your life's work. Your forte is in paleobotany and macroevolution. Why don't you tell us how that factors into the story that's evolving now?
More paleontology, not really paleobotany. I was trained as a paleontologist and as an ecologist at Yale University a long time ago, and my interests were in how changes in environments over time drive major patterns of ecology and evolution. I certainly didn't have any initial interest in human impacts on the environment, and frankly didn't think about them very much. I think that the reason I've been drawn into these issues, other than the fact that as I've gotten older, I've seen changes happen that upset me, is that as a paleontologist, I'm trained to think historically and over longer timescales than most biologists do. And that's equipped me to look at patterns and over the larger scale. My father was an historian, and I grew up hearing all about the Caribbean and the way it was in the 16th and the 17th centuries, when people were simply blown away by the extraordinary abundance of animals like turtles and sharks and sea cows and enormous fishes. And really, almost from the beginning of my career, when I went out to actually collect data on my own, what was really striking was that none of those things that I'd heard about in the past were really there. I did my PhD dissertation on the ecology of the mollusks, the clams and snails, that live in environments that we call turtle grass beds. And in the 4 years that I did that research, I never actually saw a turtle in the turtle grass bed. So it was fairly stark. The What took more time was to realize just how important those losses were. You know, the seagrass beds looked healthy and the coral reefs looked healthy, but they weren't. And then when subsequent perturbations happened and the systems didn't recover, then all those creatures that were missing took on new significance.
I know that that's one of the areas that Scripps has really focused on, some researchers are, and that is the fact that when we talk about the changes in the ocean over the last 50 years, we're starting at a broken point already.
Well, that's right. This is the notion that the great fisheries biologist Daniel Pauly developed. He calls it shifting baselines, and the term comes from the fact that any environmental scientist tries to set what we call a baseline of what the pristine condition was. The problem is, though, that everybody thinks that the way the world was when they were a kid or got started in something is the baseline.
Right.
And then the subsequent degradation that happens during their lifetimes is the problem. But of course, this phenomenon of shifting the baseline happens generation to generation to generation, and so what we accept as natural is really almost universally a pale shadow of what was there before.
Well, and even to the point of this discussion, and that is that, for example, young divers now who head into the oceans are seeing a world that is radically different than the world that, for example, you saw when you started diving.
It's when I was growing up as a kid, there were these programs like Sea Hunt on television with these big, enormous sharks. And when I started diving for my research, I kept looking over my shoulder, and then eventually I realized, well, there weren't so many of them.
Yeah.
And so the baseline was certainly dramatically shifted for me when I began my work in the 1960s. But in the 1960s, magazines like Skin Diver still showed underwater photographs of entire reefscapes. They don't do that anymore. They show close-ups of beautiful little fishes and sponges that might be 1 or 2 inches across. There aren't many beautiful reefs left to take pictures of, and so they just don't do it. And our whole standard of beauty and what we strive to see when we go underwater in the ocean has totally changed. And you know, we talk in the Florida Keys, people talk about the beautiful lime green waters, where they used to talk about the beautiful crystal clear blue water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's amazing how people will adjust. And that's a huge problem, because it means that there's no perception of change. And then, you know, these things are cumulative, and one thing follows on another, and then you get the one event that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and everybody said, oh, nobody ever told me about what was happening. But, of course, they were talking about it. And
yes.
There's very little in those articles in the Los Angeles Times that's new. I mean, the power and the elegance of those articles is to pull it all together.
Absolutely.
But this isn't new news.
Well, that is part of the sad truth for people like you and me and probably everybody who's listening right now. And that is that we've watched and been part of these warnings. We've heard them for years and years and years, and no one's paid attention, which is what has led to this is some form of ignorance and greed and many other factors. It went ignored. But
I think that, you know, most people try to make a living, and I think that, you know, out of sight, out of mind, there's a lot more interest in tropical rainforests because they're easier to come to grips with and understand, and tragically, actually, rainforests, for all the problems they have, are not in as much trouble as coral reefs are around the world. But it's much more difficult to understand that. I think that You know, there are small groups of people whose livelihood genuinely depends on the oceans, and obviously they are not wildly enthusiastic about being told they can't fish for 5 years or do this or do that. And then on the other hand, in particular, the articles in the Times focus mostly on pollution issues and things like the formation of dead zones, and it's pretty abstract for a farmer in Minnesota to make the connection between using too much nitrogen fertilizer on her fields and the consequence 2,000 miles down the Mississippi River in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think, you know, to be fair, the important thing is more to look towards the future than to dwell on the past. And now that we are coming to really accept the magnitude of these changes, the important thing is what we're going to do about them in the future.
Well, let's give a perception of really what we're talking about here. From my perspective, I'm prepared to say they are in radical decline. I'm prepared to, at this point, say they're really in crisis. And unfortunately, when you go to the ocean, everything looks the same as it did 10 years ago in many areas.
And fish are still cheap because we, as the wealthiest nation in the world, we're able to fish out and make agreements and fish out and consume at still relatively low prices, fish from all over the world. If you go into a Costco and you look carefully at where the fish came from, very, very little of the fish that we eat in this country actually comes from the waters of the United States. So it hasn't hit us in the pocketbook with the severity that it's going to pretty soon.
Well, the specific area that I'd really like for you to address, and this is the concept of the rise of slime, and that sounds disgusting, but it is, quite honestly, but I'd really like to talk about the science. What has led to that? It's a whole combination of things.
It's really pretty simple to think about. And the analogy I like to use is think about a swimming pool in somebody's backyard, and you know, the water turns green and slimy and disgusting. And why does that happen? Well, it can happen basically for one of two reasons. Either, you know, the person is really sloppy and allows mud, rainwater, and junk to get into the pool, or the other reason is that the filter breaks. And exactly the same sort of two-part situation exists in the ocean. The farmer in Minnesota or Iowa or wherever who is using lots of fertilizer and plowing deeply is generating a lot of runoff of nutrients and sediments that flow down the river and get to the ocean, and those nutrients fuel population explosions of microscopic algae that we call phytoplankton that make these dead zones.
I think the important thing there for people who haven't had a chance to really think about this is the fact that those aren't, as you say, they're nutrients. There are animals and plants that absolutely thrive on that, and that's part of the beginning of the problem.
All life does. I mean, we put fertilizer on fields of corn or wheat so that we can have more corn and wheat, and in an exactly similar way, nutrients are good, and in past environments in most places we're limiting resources for the growth of plankton, and the problem is when you have too much of it. But the other side of the story is that there were natural filters in the ocean, organisms that removed the phytoplankton, the microscopic algae, in great abundance. Those filters were things like oysters and clams and certain kinds of fish that consume absolutely extraordinary amounts of material in the water. The Chesapeake Bay was full of oysters that were so abundant that they broke the surface at low tide. They were hazards to navigation. They were charted in great detail in the middle of the 19th century, and it took almost 100 years to fish out all the oysters. We can calculate that those oysters filtered the equivalent of all the water in the Chesapeake Bay, which is the biggest estuary in the United States, in only 2 or 3 days, and they really filtered it. They filtered that water so clean that they removed almost all of the phytoplankton production. The production of these microscopic algae on a daily basis. But you know, we fish them all out. They aren't there anymore. There's almost no oysters left in the Chesapeake Bay, and so you have this double threat. You have on the one hand all these excess nutrients flowing down to the sea and fueling population explosions of these microscopic plants, and on the other hand the organisms that used to keep them in check, that used to regulate the abundance of these microscopic plants, have also been removed. And this 1-2 punch has been catastrophic, and the consequence is what we call dead zones, and they're mushrooming, appearing all over the coastal zones of the world, the Baltic Sea, the Chesapeake Bay, Pamlico Sound, the northern Gulf of Mexico, the northeastern Gulf of Mexico. These are places where there are just extraordinary population explosions of microscopic plankton occurring. These organisms become so abundant that they can't be consumed, so they simply die. As they die, they rot. That uses up all the oxygen. There's no oxygen left on the bottom. That means all the animals die, and we end up with a mess. We end up with what I call the rise of slime, which is essentially population explosions of jellyfish and bacteria. And in these places, the shrimp die, the fish die, and literally the only fisheries that survive are jellyfish.
Mm-hmm. It's quite an image, because also when we think about the entire ocean, we realize that 90% of large fish are pretty much gone at this point. And so,
and that's 90% of the fish that still were around in, say, 1950.
Right.
And there are many of the great fish like bluefin tuna that used to extend as far north as Alaska or into the Baltic Sea that stopped extending that far north 100 or 200 years ago. So the distributions of some of the largest and most important fisheries species had been truncated long before those modern fisheries data began to be collected that gives us that 90% of the big fish are gone number. This is stuff that's been going on for a very long time, although of course it's increased in intensity and efficiency dramatically in the 20th century.
Well, because I'm a very visual person, I visualize this, and what I see is a very thin ocean. What I mean by that is very little large life. It's being transplanted by the microscopic.
Well, what we're doing is we're removing all the big animals. When Columbus sailed from Spain to the New World, there were several species of animals swimming around in the North Atlantic Ocean that were a lot bigger than his ships. Hmm. It's a pretty rare thing to see animals like that anymore, and they're incredibly reduced in their abundance. We're also essentially deforesting the seafloor. We drag enormous heavy trawls over the bottom to catch groundfish and scallops and shrimp, and essentially we're turning what were very complicated landscapes into level parking lots. We're introducing species all over the world. oxygenizing the biota, we're making it warmer, we're dumping huge amounts of toxin, and the result of all of this is this rise of slime phenomenon. And I mean, you can joke about it. I like to talk about, you know, you could imagine an environmental disaster film titled Escape from Malibu, where the only people who would live in a great place like that would be the people who couldn't afford to escape to somewhere like Minnesota or Wyoming, where they'd be away from the ocean. And the only people who live there would be the people who couldn't afford to move, because the health hazards and the unattractiveness of this slimy shore would be so great that nobody who could afford better would live there. And that's already happened in some of the most beautiful stretches of coast, on the west coast of Florida, where these toxic blooms of algae are harming people's health, causing massive outbreaks of allergies, emergency rooms filling up with people who have extreme asthma and stuff like that. It's already happening, mm-hmm. and one has to hope that articles like these really terrific articles in the LA Times are going to make more people wake up to what is going on.
There was a long time when people really didn't think we could affect the oceans. I guess the baseline point here is that we're absolutely wrong about that. That we're dramatically
The solution to pollution is not dilution, because even the vast oceans are being markedly changed in their composition, because there's so many people and we produce so much garbage, and be it chemical garbage or literal garbage or nutrient garbage, and we're essentially flushing it down the toilet of the ocean, and you know, septic tanks fill up, and that's what's happening.
There are coastal areas
along the west coast of Florida.
Yes.
Barrier islands, they look almost wild.
Mm-hmm.
Spectacular beaches,
mm-hmm.
low population densities.
Paradise.
And paradise. And these dead zone phenomena are making them unattractive places to live. They close down beaches. They cause outbreaks of illness among people who move to these places to get away from the rat race or to retire. It's their, you know, their dream home, their little Shangri-La, and these phenomena are already ruining their lives.
Well, it's a real fact. It's destroying values of property. People can't live there. Health is being dramatically affected. This is not stories of things happening in the future. It's happening right now.
It's happening right now. Not everywhere right now,
no.
But it is happening right now.
Let's talk about this concept of the slime blooms, we'll call them, these massive areas that are affecting particularly coastal areas. I don't know to what degree they are
still essentially coastal,
and
there are large stretches of the coast where there's lots of mixing, lots of strong currents, or just very exposed areas where you hardly know anything happened. The tendency for these buildups to occur is obviously much greater in enclosed areas like estuaries and bays, or places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there's enormous runoff from huge population centers into relatively restricted water bodies. But as the amount of runoff increases and populations increase, then we're going to see the increase in size of these areas. And it's certainly conceivable that they will extend to occur essentially along the coastlines of most of the world.
One of the things that concerns me, I'm a biologist myself, and we all know that certain types of organisms, when they decide it's time to grow and they find the right situation to grow into, they do so very quickly. A perfect example of that is one day you're feeling fine, and then you're exposed to a cold, and the next thing, you're feeling miserable within a day. And my concern that I'd like to hear your thoughts on, once these things gain a hold, how fast do they spread? I mean, is it the type of thing where these things can spread very quickly? Because
I mean, organisms that are very small, like your analogy of the cold, tend to divide very rapidly, so their populations can increase enormously. There have always been balloons of toxic algae. They happen right here off of Scripps most summers. The question is the frequency of these events and the magnitude of the events, and I think it's almost everybody would agree that their frequency and magnitude is dramatically increasing. So under the right, or you might say wrong, combination of circumstances from our perspective, the environment becomes highly favorable for the explosive growth of these microorganisms, and in a period of a few days or weeks, they build up to enormous populations, and sometimes these blooms are so big that they extend, say, from the mouth of the Mississippi River to the Mexican border, so that's a really big area, and when they, and many of these species are toxic, and so they have a very harmful effect on fish. And in some cases, some of the species, when they come ashore, if, you know, from wave action and wind and all the rest of it, the stuff gets into the air, then we get very dramatic human health effects, which is what happens off the coast of Northwest Florida.
I've done some research, but I certainly don't have the background that you do in terms of, as you say, there's two factors. One would be the frequency, the other would be the length. And based on my preliminary research, some are suggesting that the frequency is actually increasing quite dramatically, and then as well the duration, such that therefore life on the ocean beaches, coastal areas in the future here could become absolute for long stretches of time almost uninhabitable.
In a place like California, where there's very strong California current and an awful lot of mixing, there are probably other things that are a lot more important to worry about than dead zones. But along the east coast of the United States and on the Gulf of Mexico coast of the United States, this phenomenon of, or say in San Francisco Bay, this as an enclosed area, this dead zone phenomenon really is a big deal, and it's a problem that is increasing in importance at a very, very fast rate.
It's achieving critical mass at this point. It's in some areas, and I guess maybe that therefore the question becomes, where are we in this curve?
Well, you get to the point where people understand, you know, it's not like people are going to disappear from the planet or anything like that. It's just that the impact on the quality of our lives will, I believe, increase fairly dramatically. And I think then, you know, more and more people will begin to pay attention. And the solutions, on the one hand, are obvious, but on the other hand, they're really difficult. It's like global warming. I mean, I think we're getting to the point where finally everybody gets it that the reason we're getting the buildup of CO2 and warming of the climate is because of the burning of fossil fuels. Okay, what do you do about it? I mean, we're not going to stop driving cars tomorrow. People couldn't get to work, and they couldn't make a living, so that's just unrealistic. And by the same token, you know, we want to have corn and wheat to eat, and we need food, so we're not going to stop growing food. What we need to do is to start to take these things a lot more seriously and put a lot more energy and into figuring out ways to change the ways we move around and to change the ways we grow food so that we minimize the damage that we do in the process. And there are a lot of sort of obvious ideas to pursue, but it's not simple and it's going to take time.
It makes me think of the situation in New Orleans and Katrina, where people just sort of imagined that it could never really happen, and then it did, and then guess what? We really had no capacity to deal with the dilemma. I'm concerned that we may be sort of facing some times ahead where that may be the reality.
I'm concerned about that myself, and I give very frequent public lectures about this sort of stuff, and it's difficult to grasp. And if you haven't ever been in a maximum strength hurricane, it's a little difficult to imagine what it's like. And we know that there will be a very, very, very strong earthquake in California sometime in the next 10 years or so. And we know that the likelihood of extreme damage and loss of human life is very great. But, if you haven't been through it, or if you can't really imagine an alternative, it's hard to think of what you're going to do about it. Slowly but surely, we will, as a society, learn how to think more constructively about risk and about problems for the future and act more effectively. We're really only just beginning to understand these things.
Let's think out, 10, 20, let's say that nothing happened. No changes happened. And I'm with you. I'm a political realist. Change is obvious. There's obvious things that we should be doing, but the reality of...
If we don't do anything in 20 years, is that what you're saying?
Let's say that the big ship doesn't turn, and we kind of keep on going as we typically do, and that's just what society does at this point. It's very difficult to really make significant societal change. I kind of doubt that.
But we do respond. I mean, I'm old enough to remember what really bad air pollution was like.
That's very true.
And every time there was a really bad London fog or something, lots of people would die. That's why we have a Clean Air Act. I mean, eventually it got so bad that we responded. And in the same way, I think that the situation in the oceans will get so bad that we'll start to do something about that too. I mean, it's just going to take time. And how long it'll take, well, obviously I hope it'll take less time, but it might take longer.
Dr. Jeremy Jackson with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Actually, you've discussed some scenarios in 50 years from now that we may be facing a time when large-scale life in the ocean is destined to become almost obsolete. We'll talk about this again sometime. I think I'd like to continue this discussion. You have a lot to offer. Quickly, what are three things that people could do in the next 5 years?
Well, first of all, they ought to find out for all environmental issues. They ought to develop a little bit of basic knowledge because these things are going to affect their lives in the future. And people have to take the time to just stop and think about stuff like this, especially when it gets laid in front of them as elegantly as it has been this week in the LA Times.
Yes.
The second thing they ought to do is just ask what about the way they live and the things they buy and consume can they change that might actually make a difference. And then the third thing they ought to do is ask questions about the people they vote for and whether or not those people they vote for are taking these issues seriously. And if they're not, then they ought to show their displeasure in the way they vote.
Well, Dr. Jeremy Jackson, I know that you've got some things to do, so I'm going to let you move on. Thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
The changes are real, and many of you have not been directly affected by these realities. But the first thing we learn about nature is that it is so intricately interconnected. It's up to you. It's up to us. The time is now. When we return, we look at what is happening to American democracy when the people's will is pitted against the oil well. When your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.